Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to have an assorted list.
Assortment.
Assorted.
A miscellany, or whatever you want to call it.
A miscellany. I like that one.
But interestingly enough, 2 weeks in a row, we're starting out at home.
Right
around the corner from where we live, a Pittsburgh institution called Primanti Brothers.
Everybody knows about, right?
Everybody knows about the sandwich place where they put the fries in the sandwich instead of on the side. It's notorious. It's for that, I guess. But it's fallen into really good hands.
Yes.
And they're opening the 37th version of Primanti Brothers. Opened, seriously, folks, just around the corner, not more than 600 or 700 yards from our house. So you can imagine we might be spending a little time there. Yeah. But we had the opportunity to talk to a man who spent his life in the food service business, David Head, who's been the CEO of Primanti Brothers since it was bought by private equity people about 3 years ago.
And he's a very, very thoughtful spokesperson for, we're not calling it a chain, we're calling it a family of restaurants, right?
And it's an interesting place.
It's an interesting story.
Quite a dynamic. We think you'll be entertained. So here's David Head of Primanti Brothers.
We are at a very exciting opening. Another Primanti Brothers. I have to tell David Head, who's the CEO of the owners now of the Primanti's brand. Is it a brand we call it?
Yes. Thank you, Ann. Thank you, Peter. This is our 38th Primanti Brothers that is now opened in 7 different states. But this is the first one that's been opened in the city of Pittsburgh since 1996. So in the last 3 years, we've been on the road opening a lot of restaurants, but we're really happy to be back where it all started in Pittsburgh.
Well, you know, I mean, my only exposure to Primanti Brothers was the original Primanti. I happen to note that in the Mid-Atlantic region, Primanti Brothers, a while back, won the James Beard Award for a great American classic, and that's what it has become. Can you give us just a brief history about the Primanti Brothers?
Of course. And we started in 1933, and it was a sandwich cart in the Strip District. And the idea was that we would serve truck drivers, and we would open at 11 o'clock at night and close at 11 o'clock in the daytime. And then we moved into a location where we are still at. It's on 18th Street and Smallman. And it was family-owned, family-operated. And then in 1973, it had temporarily closed when a young Greek entrepreneur named Jim Katrinas pulled on the door to come get his favorite sandwich and realized that Primanti's had closed and inquired about buying the building and buying the business, and then set about refurbishing the property and reopening in 1974 the original Primanti Brothers. And the woman who was his first employee, a lady named Toni Haggerty, still works with the company. She's a 72-year-old Italian grandmother. We love her. She works 5 days a week, 40 hours every week, and is the personality, the soul, and really the heart of the company. So still there, doing great, and known and loved by all.
But the story goes on. You really reverted to a different business model. It's the original Primanti's expanded. Tell us what about the expansion, and also what changes occurred in the business, the identity.
So Jim Petrinas and Tony, and then Jim's partner, a gentleman named Nick Nicholas, set about growing Primanti Brothers in the city of Pittsburgh. They opened up Cherry Way and Oakland, Southside, and then in 96 opened up Market Square. And then a few years later decided, let's see if it will work in the suburbs. So they went out to Robinson Township and into North Versailles, and it proved that the formula worked. They modified it slightly, added more of a well-rounded menu with some fresh baked pizza and some fresh ground beef burgers and the like, and some great wings, and added a lot of television. And then we're in a position where it just kept growing. And it would, every 2 years, 3 years, they would open a new restaurant. And then eventually, you know, it came up to 2012, and they had a lot of other business interests. They're both prominent throughout Pittsburgh and in Florida, and decided to take on an equity partner and see if Primanti Brothers could expand beyond the Pittsburgh market.
Now, we mustn't forget, for those people around the world who are listening and wondering what all the fuss is about, that there's a signature item which some people think is really exciting, some people think is really stupid. It's clear to me, because in the part of the world where I come from, if you go to the chippy, the fish and chip shop, one of the items you can get is what's called a chip butty, which is a sandwich, a bread sandwich with chips in it. But that's all that's inside of it. So how did this legendary sandwich come about?
So, Peter, thank you for reminding me about the true star of the show. So this was, the idea was, when we opened this restaurant, that you had a grill and you would make these hot sandwiches with various meat, and then you would melt cheese on top of it and put it on fresh baked Italian bread. As legend had it, somewhere along the line, no one's really sure the exact date that someone had this brainstorm, but a trucker was in a hurry and they took some potatoes and they cut them open to see if they were still good or not, and said, well, let's just fry them up instead of, you know, baking them. Let's just put them right on the flat top and let's see if they'll, you know, cook them up and let's see how they taste. And so they took the Italian bread, fresh baked Italian bread, and we still get it baked 365 days a year, delivered every day, and delivered to the restaurants in the morning. And then it's 20 different lunch meats, fresh sliced cheese, hand-cut French fries, fresh potatoes every day, a vinaigrette-based coleslaw, which is it's not a heavy coleslaw, it's a sweet and sour, tangy, and then topped with two slices of tomatoes. So it's about a pound of food. It is all fresh, all natural ingredients, and it's still made the way it was in the 1930s.
Now, I mean, you probably know one of your biggest supporters and promoters is Mario Batali, and he's always tweeting, people want to know where to eat in Pittsburgh. He always says, Primanti's. But there's a whole lot of nostalgia built into this, and an ethnicity that's really specific to Pittsburgh. Where are you from, David, and how do you think this shifting of locations affects the basic ethnicity of a particular Rust Belt city?
Well, I'm originally from Maryland, and so I'm an East Coast guy, and I went to school in Miami, I've lived in Virginia, and I have operated and been a partner in restaurants all up and down the East Coast. When we looked at Primanti Brothers, our partners, a company called Catterton Partners, which is in the private equity world, they're well-known restaurant investors. We looked for real, authentic, genuine concepts that have a certain soul to them. And, you know, we looked at this product, we looked at did a lot of research behind it, and there was a lot of science that went into determining latent demand. And, you know, when we looked at where we could expand the company, because we believe a business, it's either growing or dying, right? There's no in between. And the original Primanti Brothers was just one. Eventually, it just died out because there's, you know, and when we get great people, and we get, you'll see all these great young people who want to be part of something growing, you have to provide growth opportunities for them. As Jim Petrinas and Nick Nicholas, they took the company up to 20 restaurants in 34 years. So they always had growth going as well. But we looked at cities that have matched kind of the feel and the vibe of Pittsburgh. It's cities like, you know, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Detroit. We've gone out to York, Pennsylvania, up to Erie, Pennsylvania. And these are areas that really care about great food, great value, great portions, great quality. And so, you know, I doubt you're going to see Primanti in San Francisco or Los Angeles. We could see cities like St. Louis or Louisville or Nashville, cities with great culture and deep roots, embracing what we're all about.
Just give me some summation of, like, what is it that differentiates Primanti Brothers from any other serious, authentic chain restaurant?
Well, we... And we don't really call ourselves a chain. We're more like we're a family of restaurants. They all look different. Every one that you see will look slightly unique. And, as we're here at the Garfield East Penn location tonight, this is a completely different location. But what differentiates us, first of all, is the sandwich, which is oft, imitated, but never duplicated. And, you know, serious foodies such as the James Beard folks were gracious enough to award us unsolicited, you know, an American classic restaurant that Jim Petrinas, you know, accepted and deserves. And he is our, we view him as a spiritual father of the company. And the other thing I think is our people. And we don't have a lot of rules. We're straightforward. We embrace all types of folks. We have diversity and great, you know, just a great disparity of people. We go into urban locations. We go into country locations. We're in different cities. You know, a lot of chains become regimented and uniform, and everyone has to look the same, and they have a speech. I mean, if somebody walked up to the table and said, "Hi, my name's Ann. I'll be your server this evening, and tonight's specials are blah," we'd probably fire them or tell them to go somewhere else. We'd rather they say, "Hey, you guys look thirsty tonight. You look like you need a beer. Let me tell you what we have." Or, you know, "What are you in the mood for this evening?" Or, "You look a little grumpy. Let's get you something." Or we want people with personality. And as we say, we like to, you know, we like to train them our way, but then have them do the job their way. And it works. People embrace that.
Have you ever been in Primanti? I'm sure you have. This is a stupid question. I don't know how you can ever replicate the experience of being at 3 a.m. in Primanti's in the Strip in Pittsburgh.
That's true. The Strip is still one of two restaurants we have that's open 24 hours. The other one's on the beach in Fort Lauderdale. And come hurricane, come rain, shine, it's open. No, you know, when the Strip, in the heyday of the Strip in the 1970s, we still hear from people, everyone I meet says, "I remember being at the Strip at 3 in the morning, and it was the greatest cross-section of people you could ever see, and we would... You can't serve alcohol past 2 o'clock in Pennsylvania, most states. Some of them you can serve till 3. But we still do business between midnight and 7 or 8 in the morning down at the original Strip District. People come in from all over the world and cab drivers and now Uber drivers and Lyft drivers will take them down to the original strip to still get a feel of the Primanti brothers as it was.
I have to tell you, every celebrity in town heads first to Primanti brothers.
The interesting thing is that you have moved back into actually our neighborhood. We are less than half a mile away from On the Menu headquarters, and there are two groups of people who are going to take the message of Primanti Brothers out, whether you like it or not, so you better treat them well. That's the 1,000 to 1,500 employees of Google and the 500 employees of Uber who are testing and perfecting the Uber driverless vehicle. And I have a feeling there might be a place for Primanti Brothers in Silicon Valley after all.
Well, you're exactly right. And one of the thing we love about Pittsburgh is this is a city that has reinvented itself economically numerous times in the last 200 years. And to see it being on the cutting edge of technology is very exciting. Whether you're a very young person, a millennial, a Gen Y, Gen X, a boomer like myself, everyone really appeals. Everyone, likes Primanti's because it's still the real deal and it's still very authentic. And what I'm blessed with is we've been so closely aligned with the city of Pittsburgh, which is enjoying a great renaissance. When President Clinton and Hillary came here in the late 90s, they came to the Strip. When Hillary was campaigning this year for the Democratic nomination, she came to Market Square. Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, it doesn't matter. We serve sandwiches proudly to everybody, and everybody likes us. And when the media comes, whether it's Jimmy Fallon or Sofia Vergara, and her husband Joe, they love us. Joe's just the best. I mean, this guy, anybody that can get Sofia to embrace a Primanti sandwich, we love him. So it's really a fun, exciting concept. And I'm not from Pittsburgh, but I'm smart enough to know the real thing when I see it.
Well, I can hear the noise rising in the background, so you're going to be in demand. I want to say, in the midst of this interview, I managed to consume some wings, which I enjoyed. And I thank you so much, David Head. And right on, go Primanti Brothers.
Thank you very much. Anna, Peter, thanks so much for taking time. And we look forward to serving the community and the city and all the markets we're in for a long time. Thank you very much.
Trust me, listeners, it was even louder than it sounds in the background. this place was sure was hopping.
Yes.
And I'll bet it's hopping every night.
I think it is. And we certainly ate our share of the...
We did.
Yeah.
We ate two Primanti sandwiches between the two of us.
Yes.
Which is...
They're large.
Only Mario Batali we know does that. Anyway, we'll be back. Don't go away because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We've interviewed anytime there's a new resource, such as we get from Aaron Coopy. We'd like to bring these resources to your attention. Aaron helps promote the kinds of things you need to have on hand to be able to cook really well. And adding to her pantry book, which told you what to buy, put in, she has a whole new book that lets you get extra mileage by infusing flavors. In fact, that's what the book's called.
Infusions.
infusing
flavors. What a surprise. So here's Aaron Kubi's...
Infusing flavors. We say that fast 7 times.
Can't.
Yeah. When we've interviewed Aaron Kubi before about her book about what you should have in stored in your pantry, this new one is all about infusing flavors, which is really a hot trend right now, Aaron, isn't it?
It seems to be. It pops up everywhere. I've had people say to me, this just seems to be the next big thing. So hopefully I'm at the edge of the trend there.
And you put these in your pantry too anyway, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, you have all these different categories. Let me repeat what I said to you when you phoned in is what I like about your writing is, I mean, you're really reliable and you just get right to it and you just write it and there's nothing that anybody needs to worry about not understanding or asking questions because you explain it all.
Well, I really appreciate that. You know, I've had lots of readers say to me that reading my book is like having a friend in the kitchen, uh-huh. and they feel as though I'm standing next to them just kind of talking it through. And that's really the way I like to communicate about food. I don't want it to be complicated or too hard to follow, and you know, because otherwise you won't do it, right?
Right. But you uncomplicate it in this book.
I try.
Let's talk about how it's organized and what the categories of infusions, or in fact, what is an infusion?
Because I was really surprised. I thought I couldn't possibly be interested in a book on infusions. Doesn't sound like anything I'd be very interested in at all. And I was quite gripped with it.
How about celery bitters?
Well,
I don't want to jump ahead. How about you start and explain? Yeah.
What infusions are. Well, so everybody, probably every single one of us has quote-unquote made an infusion because that's as simple as making a mug of tea or making a pot of coffee. Those are both infusions, and for the most part, we consider those standard infusions, although technically coffee making falls into what's called decocting. So a standard infusion is just basically steeping some sort of botanical, herb, flower, fruit, etc., in water. That's a standard infusion. And from there are cold infusions, and typically cold infusions are done with something that has sometimes a little bit more acidity to it, whether that's vinegar or alcohol, but it's certainly a slower process. And just, it is exactly what I was saying at the room temperature, a cold infusion that takes a little longer to kind of extract flavor. Then there's something called decocting, and decocting is really just simmering. And so that would be like taking some tuber roots like a rhizome of turmeric and simmering that kind of slowly to get the flavors out of it.
Yeah, we like that.
Pouring hot water. Yeah,
like turmeric root. We use that a lot.
Oh, love it too.
And it makes a good martini, Peter discovered.
Oh, excellent. I'll have to give that a try myself.
Yeah.
So the last thing is then percolating, and we've all heard of those old-fashioned percolators. And I didn't do a lot with percolation in the book because so many people don't own percolators. But I thought it was just an interesting thing to kind of talk about. And by the way, I'm a fan of the percolator. I came up with my percolation recipe because I use a percolator to do coffee every day.
Do
and
you
I think
really?
It's a far richer flavor than a drip pot, and you use half the coffee. So, you know, there's my plug for the percolation industry.
Now, does our coffee maker percolate? Rather, it makes that little noise.
Yes.
We have a Remington iCoffee machine.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
It's fabulous. It really is great.
Excellent.
Yeah. And it does the extraction with steam rather than water. So it really gets the flavor out of the coffee.
Yeah, very, very much more rich and rounded. And I'm a big fan.
And so that's one of the, you know, this, what is it you said was decalc what?
Decoction. And really, let's just call that simmering.
Okay.
That's just when you are researching and learning about different ways to infuse, decoction comes up But in layman's terms, it's just simmering as opposed to pouring hot water over something and letting it sit. It's actively simmering that to get more flavor out of whatever you're infusing.
I have to double check.
Hold on a minute. But it's simmering rather than percolating, and percolating is simmering that's a little bit hotter.
Percolating technically means, just in the way that you described it, that kind of flush of steaming hot liquid kind of rotating. So it's constantly kind of pushing up and coming down through again, pushing up. If you imagine those old-fashioned percolators, they usually have a center tube that runs up the middle and a basket that holds the coffee, or for this particular recipe in the book, that would hold spices. And the liquid is heated, forced up to the top, and then slowly drips down through whatever it is that you are trying to infuse, whether that's coffee beans or spices for hot spiced lemonade.
You know, I think that this book that we're going to be interviewing the author of, this book on, another hot trend is edibles, weed, cannabis. And they recommend doing something like that before you start using it in baked goods. I don't know.
I have heard that about infused cannabis oils, that sometimes in order to get an active ingredient, they did have to kind of bring it up to a certain temperature. But I've never experimented with it personally.
Well, I mean, it's certainly that and bugs. I haven't been able to get my head around that. I like to stay up on trends, but there is a limit.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you talk about the flavor revolution. Well, I had a question. I said I don't have any questions, but I really do have a question about sterilizing bottles, jars, and containers.
Yes.
I don't understand it. I mean, I understand if you boil something. When I make my preserved lemons, I run the jars through the dishwasher.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't understand is immediately when they're exposed to air, they're unsterilized.
Well, here's the thing. In cooking in the culinary industry, there's something called the temperature danger zone. So that refrigerated food that is below 41 degrees is safe from bacterial growth because it retards and slows the bacterial growth. Above, 141 degrees or 165 degrees, that also kind of shuts down the growth. So when we're simmering or boiling things, that's why they tell you to cook chicken or pork to 165, 170 degrees. Because in between the range of about 41 degrees and 165 degrees is perfect temperature for growth of bacteria. So the reason that we think about sterilizing jars and bottles and then using them immediately after they're taken out of the water is so that other items don't kind of implant on the surface or have a chance to kind of take hold. And so that's the whole reason behind when they tell you to sterilize something and then fill it while it's still hot. It's just so that we're not giving that container time to cool to the point that bacterial growth could start, and we're sealing it quickly again to keep the air out, and that's just another way to kind of control degradation and bacterial growth.
But you say it has to be dry, and this is true in everything I read about fermenting anything. You got to get it dry, but if you set it to air dry, you're giving it more chance to get bugs or germs or whatever. And if you're wiping it with something, if it's not a sterile gauze or something, you're introducing more.
I'm more concerned when I'm talking about drying about the outside, because most of the time what we're adding is a liquid. However, when I take something out of the boiling water or when I'm sterilizing those jars, if I'm going to, for example, be filling it with oil, and oil would create this anaerobic environment if there is moisture in there, then I simply set that jar upside down on a drying rack, and then when it is basically dry, I'm not introducing bacteria by putting a towel up inside of it, but I do try to use that when it's still quite hot to the touch, and, it's just kind of the balance of the whole home canning thing. You know, we just try to keep things as controlled as possible.
Okay, so you run us through teas and tisanes.
Yes.
And you can make teas and tisanes out of just about everything, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I tried to give a whole bunch of different ideas so that people would take this book and realize how easy it is to be creative through infusions, and then to just start to play with their own blends and not be afraid of kind of trying different things in that sense. And the way I, as you've seen, the way I laid the book out is basically it kind of falls halfway between being a book about different drinks and halfway between a book about different kind of food infusions. And so to kind of, you know, lead people in, I thought, well, we've all probably taken a tea bag and steeped a cup of tea, so it seemed to be a very simple way to kind of move forward. And then the second most basic extraction that we might have would be, the infusion, I should say, would be an extraction. And often extractions were used making alcohol and also used in primarily for their health benefits. So it's kind of the progression, you know. The you might sip on something that tastes good, and medicinally you might get effect from that tea, but what are ways to make that same infusion last longer or get more out of whatever you botanical you're using? So those, you know, vinegars, those alcohols are ways to get a longer-lasting infusion, something that isn't simply boiled and used immediately kind of thing. So that was the transition or the thought behind the layout of the book, and that kind of takes us through the drinks. And then from there, we get a little bit more in terms of experimenting with other culinary flavors.
Yeah, you're big on bitters. I mean, everybody is. That's another trend. Bitters, digestivos. I mean,
yes. Exactly. And they're fascinating. And one of the things that I mentioned in the book is that, you know, we have very vibrant bitters industry here in the United States prior to Prohibition. And bitters were really originally created as medicines.
Yeah.
And to settle one's stomach. And you know, I love and collect all sorts of ancient cookbooks, and I have them dating back to the 1800s.
Indeed.
And, you find often lots of different recipes for bitters, syrups for sodas, things like that. But, you know, today we don't think about that because we just go out to the store and buy them. But they were very, very commonplace for not only the homemaker, but as industry in the U.S. prior to Prohibition. And then Prohibition just kind of knocked that industry right out of the water. So it's kind of fun to see it making a little bit of a comeback.
Yeah, well, we were talking just before we came on the air about Switchel.
Yeah.
And Switchel came up in conversation with another guest a couple of weeks ago, and we couldn't remember what it was called, but fortunately he or she remembered. But for our audience's benefit, why don't you explain what a Switchel is and why?
Absolutely. Well, I put Switchels into a chapter called Shrubs, Switchels, and Kombuchas. And both shrubs and switchels kind of follow the same basic tack. But in a sense, prior to the invention of soft drinks, in the colonial period, it was felt that something would be much more refreshing if it caused you to kind of salivate a little bit when you drank it. So we've all had a tart beverage that made our mouth water a little bit. So the idea was that tartness was satiating, more so than just simply water. So the idea for a switchel would have been a very old-fashioned way to make kind of a sweet and sour drink. And what I like to say to people is this is flavor-wise not very far off a good old-fashioned lemonade. Although it is made with cider vinegar as a more predominant ingredient than lemon juice. But if you're willing to drink lemonade, then try a switchel or a shrub because it's the same kind of idea. You're taking a tart liquid, and you're adding a sugar or some other sweetener. In the case of a switchel, that's often something like a molasses or a maple syrup. And then you're cutting that with water. So you're making your own kind of sweet and sour beverage. And so if I said to people, hey, a shrub is a sipping vinegar that we then cut with sparkling water, they'd say, ew, vinegar. I'm not going to eat that. But saying to them, but if you're willing to drink a lemonade, it's the same core base. Then it kind of helps people get their mind around that kind of step towards shrubs and switchels.
Now, so. I remember somebody actually sent us some that was based on like a 17th century recipe. And that was really, we were really taken with it, but we sort of never knew what it was. Now, another thing you give such a lot of information, and I have never been able to explain before, but now I can. What the difference is between ginger ale and ginger beer.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Now, just to show you how deep your knowledge is, why don't you go over that one?
Excellent. Well, the difference primarily between a ginger ale and a ginger beer is that a ginger beer is fermented to create the carbonation. And so you would use a yeast in the same way that you would to make a commercial beer or an artisan beer or a root beer to create the bubbles and the carbonation. And a ginger ale is a syrup, like an old-fashioned soda syrup. And some of us are still old enough to remember, you know, going into a drugstore and saying, I would like a lemon soda.
Yeah,
and watching the
Coke.
Soda jerk. Yes, exactly. Pump some, you know, flavored syrups into a glass and then add sparkling water. And so now what we're, we want to kind of say a soda is a soda because it's all contained. But the truth is artisan homemade sodas are syrups that we add carbonation to via whether that's a soda stream system or a bottle of seltzer or soda water versus a beer, meaning it has gone through a slight fermentation process which has created those bubbles as opposed to adding them separately.
So something like sarsaparilla, for example, would be a...
Typically a sarsaparilla would be, because sarsaparillas were created by... In old senses, it's really hard to kind of delineate between a root beer and a sarsaparilla and, you know, other drinks because they are really kind of created the same way. And it wasn't until companies like, you know, Hires and Barks and things came on the scene and kind of made a standard root beer that we got a specific flavor, but a sarsaparilla was made from a root as well, and sometimes that sarsaparilla was used in an old-fashioned root beer blend. And so, you know, typically a sarsaparilla would have been a fermented beverage in the same way that a root beer or a ginger beer would, as opposed to a syrup extraction.
Wow.
I know, wow.
We sure know a lot here. I'm going to let you loose on one final item here because, again, it's everywhere. Everybody's drinking kombucha.
Yeah.
And actually, I had a masseur once who said that her friends thought she was awful drinking kombucha when she was pregnant, that the baby was going to be, whatever you call it, alcohol dependent or something, whatever. But, so I didn't really understand that because I'm not sure I understand kombucha. But what is it?
Well, kombucha is a Japanese fermented tea. And so basically you make kind of a very light tea mixture to which you add a good amount of sugar, and you use something called a SCOBY, which is, I can go through, it's a symbiotic culture of bacteria.
It's like
a
mother.
But basically,
isn't it?
It's a mother, exactly. So it starts that fermentation process, and it begins to eat the sugar. And slowly over the course of, you know, a week usually to, depending on the weather, maybe 2 to 3 weeks if it's a little cooler, you get a beverage that is, again, slightly sweet and sour, but because of the SCOBY, it is also filled with probiotics, which are very gut healthy these days. Now, with the kombucha, it is pretty important during the first fermentation to just use a very straightforward tea, a green tea, a black tea, to make the kombucha itself. And the infusion part of that doesn't happen until after the fact when you are kind of doing what's called a secondary fermentation, and that's when you say to yourself, okay, I've got this basic kombucha. What kind of flavors do I want to add to it? Do I want to make it a ginger flavor? Do I want to make it a lavender flavor? And so you add in a little bit more of a botanical, and then you do a secondary cold infusion for a few days, and that's what kind of creates the infused flavor of a kombucha.
I bet you don't have any Coke or Pepsi in your house, do you?
I don't. I don't, and I used to love the Diet Cokes, but now as I've gotten older, I've been trying to be so much better, and I do definitely my own artisan sodas, and my husband, you know, keeps me busy making ginger ale and ginger beer on a regular basis. So.
Well, thank you so much. Yes. Thank you so much for joining us.
There's so much more in this book, so...
my pleasure. Tell everybody to check out the food recipes, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, and desserts. I mean, you have a huge section on desserts. And
absolutely.
And they're delicious on top of everything else. So, okay, Erin Coopy, you're a delight, as usual. And your latest book, Infusing Flavors, should be on everybody's fall book list.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Thanks, Erin. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we had a little in-house controversy over the next subject. Is it pronounced cannabis or cannabis?
I'm telling you, it's cannabis.
It's cannabis.
I said cannabis at the gym, and all the people in them were all left.
They all left. Yeah, yes. I understand it a lot.
But believe us, listeners, we keep getting information about this. It's a new big business. I mean,
well, it's a huge business.
It's going to be. It's very expensive to get into. It's going to make a lot of money for the people that get into it right at the outset. I don't know which is hotter, the cannabis or bugs. I mean, both of them.
Well, cannabis got hotter since we recorded this interview because there were ballot questions on the subject of recreational use or medicinal use of cannabis up the yin yang back in November, and quite a number of states, some of which you would have been surprised about, actually said it's a long time since we should have made this legal one way or another. And so when that happens in your neighborhood, here's some explanations as to what that means. You can do what you should and shouldn't do when cooking with cannabis. What are some good recipes? Cannabis. Hey, I got it wrong. All right, sweetheart. Score one for you and score.
You know, well, actually, I was going to say we could just refer to it as weed, but that's not what it's called now. It's called edibles now.
Edibles. Okay. Yeah. Edibles. So if somebody's making edibles, you'll know what it is.
Yes.
And in the meantime, why don't we just play this interview?
Exactly. Laurie Goldrich Wolf, you're going to be rich, I think, if I read the market correctly. We're talking about your book, Cooking With, and I've been corrected so many times, it's cannabis. I kept calling it cannabis, but I guess it's cannabis. People laughed at me. So I thought I'd correct it.
Can we just call it weed?
Yeah. Well, no, you're not allowed to call weed anymore. No,
because I guess weed is not considered the appropriate.
No.
I'm not even sure marijuana is, just because it has a history kind of racism and...
racism? For that, I didn't know that.
Marijuana came from the Maria Juana, and it was a Mexican term. And one of the reasons why cannabis is so frowned upon is because the influx of Mexican people into the southern states caused terrible racism and fear in people who thought that although we in this country used cannabis in some medicines, the fact that in Mexico it was a custom to use cannabis recreationally, there was all sorts of horrible things written about what will happen when people start to use cannabis. And it made a lot of people fearful that new people in the country were going to.
That was a la Donald Trump, huh?
Well, you know, I was just watching I'm honestly sick about this.
About what?
About Donald Trump.
But let's get back.
Let's have another interview about Donald Trump. you know, Justin, I can say all the horrible things that I've been thinking. Yeah, anyway. Well,
So there is an element of xenophobia having to do with cannabis.
Yes, I think that it's changing. I have seen a new demographic. So we make edibles and we sell them to dispensaries. And
so you started out in this whole business as dealing with medical marijuana.
Yes, I mean it was only medical. So people, I know that there were people who had licenses who didn't really, like some people were able to get medical cards really without a serious medical condition, but initially we were dealing with people who were trying to use marijuana for, you know, health reasons, for pain management.
Now you, for example, you write that you had epilepsy and that this actually prevented seizures.
Yes, it's been amazing. It's for almost 3 years now, I have been using the tiniest bit of cannabis daily, not enough to affect my thinking, but I have been aura and seizure-free between 3 and 4 weeks into my trying cannabis. It's as if I never had it. Now, I don't know that it's gone, but it's being managed, and I don't have any... it's been so long now that I don't have any concerns that, it's been incredible, better than any of the medications that I was taking. And a couple of those medicines, I had to have blood tests every 3 months because they could be damaging to my liver or damaging to my kidneys. You know, these were strong, strong, powerful medications, and I don't take them anymore.
You are by training a chef.
Yes.
Okay.
I went to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park.
Oh, good.
New York. Yeah.
And so you've worked all these years as a chef. So
well, I worked as a chef for my first 4 years out of the Culinary Institute, and then I got involved in publishing, and I was a food stylist. And I was food editor at Mademoiselle magazine for the year before they realized that nobody who read the magazine ate anything. I was like, how much can you do with a head of lettuce? And then I became a food stylist primarily. I did that for several years. Then I was offered the job at Child magazine, a parenting magazine. And I did food for families. And I was there for 19 years until the magazine
closed.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, I saw a lot of people come and go, you know, a lot of editors-in-chief. And somehow they kept me. And it was great because it was during the time when I was raising my kids. And it just, having a steady job worked perfectly. And it was a great group.
Now, but you're on the end. You're not producing the plants or the substance.
No. I mean, I am growing a couple of plants, but not very well.
Uh-huh.
I don't seem to have a green thumb. I have friends who have the same plants that I have that started when they were tiny little things.
Yeah.
And mine are just a nightmare. And theirs, they're like sending me pictures. It's like, look at the size of these buds, and they're like, send me yours, and I'm not sending anything because they look absolutely horrible. So we have people who supply us with the cannabis.
Okay, and you were working on ways of and recipes for using the cannabis medicinal and the recreational applications?
Well, our the license we're going for is the recreational license. However, I have people who, you know, are kind of my patients that I help with product. But you have to kind of choose which license you're going to get. So we're going after the rec license. I'm not exactly sure what's happening with medical licensing and medical marijuana here. But I will say I am working with a man who has severe rheumatoid arthritis. And he literally, like when he came to me, it was just a couple of months ago, his hand, he couldn't open his hand. No, it was like twisted closed. And he started using our infused coconut oil, and he can open his hands now. And so he told a friend who had a similar issue, and they both say it's a miracle. You know, I did not have a whole lot of hope for him, like for that kind of a, you know, huge improvement. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he said he hasn't been able to open his hand in many, many years. Mm-hmm. It was phenomenal to see that happen.
Now, Laurie, where are you geographically? Because this is one of the things that's really weird about this whole thing is the variation from state to state across this country. Now, so again, you're where?
Portland.
I'm in Oregon.
You're in Oregon, okay.
We should point out recreational and medicinal. Weed or cannabis is legal. And I started asking you before we started the official interview here that I had heard that there was a great deal of money to be made in this emerging business, and that I heard it was a very expensive operation or very expensive venture to try to get into the business. And how did you do that?
Well, it is very expensive, but I did not and have not at this point taken on any investors. People have asked, I would prefer not to do that. So, you know, there's lots of expensive equipment to be purchased, and we haven't done that. You know, I don't have a lot of money. I'm putting money into ingredients and the kitchen. You know, we're doing it kind of, we started small and are hoping to build without having to take investors. I don't know. I mean, we get calls all the time from venture capitalists. And,
really?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Because people do see it as, and mistakenly believe that people in the business now who have businesses like mine are getting ridiculously rich. And at this point, we are definitely not losing money. I would say we're making money, but it would by no means be considered, you know, that we've gotten rich.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it was Mindy Siegel that I met at the Beard Awards in Chicago.
Yeah.
Wasn't it Mindy who was working with a scientist in a lab in the development of her recipes?
Right.
She wanted to go beyond brownies, you see. So she's been working on this for a while. And I don't think it's legal in Illinois, is it?
Probably not yet, but
I
would guess it'll get there.
Yeah, that's what she's banking on, I'm sure.
And she's a top chef. She's one of the top pastry chefs in the country.
Yes.
So
So
after a different market than you are, I think.
Well, you know, we do a little brownie and we do a little almond cake, and now we've added a kind of chocolate chip cookie. Everything we do is in mini muffin cups, and they're really fabulous. Like we decided to, because we see who is coming into the dispensaries now, that at the end of the day, most people, at least in Oregon, want something sweet. And it used to be that nobody cared what it tasted like as long as it got you high.
Yeah.
So when I got into the business, there were absolutely dreadful things offered. It was like somebody took a bud of marijuana and dipped it in chocolate, you know, and called it, you know. I mean, if you just could not believe what you were eating. And I would, you know, say, wow, you know, who made this? Oh, my grandmother made this. You know, or, oh, I make them every night. You know, I smoke a bowl and I make like 50 treats. And it seemed that there was no attempt to disguise the flavor or to make a dessert that the flavor actually helped. They were pretty brutal. And I thought, it was around that time that I was feeling the benefits of using cannabis and not having to take my kind of nasty pharmaceuticals, that I thought, you know how to cook, I know how to bake, let's see if I can, you know, make an edible that won't, like, taste like weed, or I shouldn't say weed, right?
And, we have to learn a whole new language here.
Yes, yes.
Well, your book, it starts out with basics, all about what cannabis is, and then you do a crash course. You emphasize that you should do as little dose wise as possible. Even help with what to do when you overdo it. And as I understand it, controlling the amount is one of the biggest issues. Like people who cook, who have a dinner party, it's hard to control because every person has a different level of ability to consume without going overboard, right?
Yes, absolutely. Because we're in the business, everything we make is tested in a lab. So we know what the amount of THC, which is the psychoactive cannabinoid in cannabis, we know how much is in there. So if we're having a cannabis dinner party, we always do it very low dose, and everybody knows exactly what's in it. Five milligrams of THC is a very low, comfortable dose for most people. People who are nervous about it, I will say, eat half and wait several hours and try the next night.
Yeah, you say stay at home. You say don't even plan on ingesting. You're going to be out. That's not going to happen.
Yes, I do know that that's not going to happen. And I also know that being a little high on cannabis and driving seems to be less dangerous than being a little drunk. Because what people say is, you know, yes, I got there, but it took me, 4 hours and it was a mile away. So you tend to be much more cautious, I think. That's what I found. Then, like with alcohol, it's like, let's have a keg and, go for a ride. This is most people's reaction to cannabis is kind of a more mellow, focused, not kind of crazy antics. There'll be a very different room than it's people drinking beer and people smoking joints or eating edibles. It doesn't really make anybody rowdy, reckless. It's not like that.
Well, but you're a chef, and when people are talking about terroir with marijuana, I've smoked, and I don't remember any particular nuances of flavors at all.
When you have a glass of wine, can you tell what the notes are?
Yes, I've done blind tastings.
Oh, wonderful. I do think that there are prominent terpenes, which are the cannabinoids that inform the flavor of cannabis. And if you have, you know, a really good nose or palate, it is possible to say, boy, this is a little citrusy, or this one seems kind of woodsy or piney. You know, I can do it somewhat, but I certainly, you know, can't name like six things that I, you know, taste or, but people do. I mean, there are cannabis schools opening up. I saw that we got invited to one in Colorado where you try 50 strains and get to know like what the flavors are and what the terpenes and flavonoids are. I certainly can't do it with wine, and you know I'm
Let me ask you this: If you make a soup,
yes,
and I mean, do you try to select a particular cannabis flavor to go in that soup?
Uh-huh. That's a great question. We use the same two strains of cannabis in our business. We use, you know, we use the strains from the same grower, so we have a consistent product. However, we have done dinner parties here, and we will, and if the dinner party is a terpene pairing event, we will pick foods and cannabis that we feel work together. So, you know, we will use a woodsy, like I love to do stuffed mushrooms or some mushroom dish with a cannabis that I feel pairs really well. The flavors are good. I will say with these dinners, after the third test, it becomes much harder to be very...
Yeah, that's the other question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like by the third one, people are like, oh, no. Well, I have no idea.
Congratulations, you know, like, by the way, on being part of this new world, Laurie Goldrich Wolf.
Thank you.
I particularly liked your section on what snacks to make when you get the munchies, because I remember everybody going overboard on Zagnut bars.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
So,
I have healthy things in my house when I'm stoned.
Well,
you know, I will try and eat snow peas rather than, you know, an entire cake. But it requires effort.
Yeah, well, I just think that, you know, if anybody's exploring this, this is that basic book that takes you through all the condiments, infusions, which is one of the ways of, the major way of getting the flavors out of this. Again, it's Cooking with Cannabis, and now I'm pronouncing it right. That's an advance for me. And Laurie, I hope it all works out with you, and I'm glad that you've got medical relief from it as well.
Yeah, thank you. And if you're ever coming to Oregon, I'm happy to make a dinner for you.
Oh, aren't you sweet? That would be a treat.
Yeah, it would be fun.
Okay, dear. Well, thank you.
All right.
Ciao.
Oh, thank you.
Ciao, Laurie.
It's been my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Okay, listeners, so there you have it, another On the Menu program in the bag. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.